Well, I'm going to, deal with a week in politics, but very much with the headlines in mind. I have to deal with Israel, Palestine, the Middle East first and foremost. So I'm going to squeeze in a couple of other questions at the very end. So yeah, let's begin with Israel, Palestine. We're getting a sort of trickle of information, for what it's worth, of various intelligence that Israel must have been in receipt of. So Egypt has issued statements saying, "We told you something was going on." We also, I think, understand that, no surprise, that this whole operation took Hamas a year to prepare for. So, in terms of training, in terms of working out, what to do, who to do it, this is not something that was ordered. The go-ahead might be, but this isn't something that's come out of the blue, and it couldn't have come out of the blue. So this has been something that's, as I said, that's been on the drawing board, and certainly has been on the radar of Egypt, and you would have thought others for some time. And therefore, yeah, one we need to factor in that these are only glimpses of what an intelligence service will be getting. So one would presume that they're in receipt of masses of information. The real question is then interpreting that information. So it's not that the electronic surveillance broke down. It's not that every human asset that Shin Bet has got in and around Hamas has been eliminated or has done an about turn. That information would be coming in. It's a question of what Israel did in terms of acting upon it. Now, I'm not going, and I said this last week, I'm not going down any sort of conspiracy hole, because once you do that, then too many other consequences flow from it. All I would suggest is that the intelligence agencies have been flooded with information, but the Israeli government has been busy with other questions, not least the survival of that government, not least the survival of the prime minister. Okay, it's also worth mentioning at this opening stage one story in terms of Hamas atrocities, and there clearly has been atrocity. One story has been officially, from my understanding, scotched, and that's the idea that Hamas militants went into Israel and particularly targeted children and then beheaded them. This turns out not to be true, even though Joe Biden, in some of his remarks, said he saw it. He didn't see it. And it turns out to be one of those Chinese whispers, that go down. I think it comes from some soldier. And it's quite conceivable that in a rocket strike or something like that, you would have found a decapitated baby, for example. Maybe that's where the story came from. But the fact of the matter is, of course, that what this operation was designed to do is to strike terror into the heart of Israel, to provoke it. I think that would also be fair to say. So while there were definitely targets that you could describe as military, so border posts, police stations, and the like, the idea wasn't to concentrate on such targets. No, the idea was to unleash terror on Israel, to get Israel to retaliate in a way that Hamas, I presume, on some basis, would then be able to bank on the reaction not only of the Palestinians in the West Bank, not only Palestinians in Jordan, in Lebanon, and other such countries, but the Muslim masses, and we need to use the word Muslim masses in the Middle East, would rise up. That seems to me to be what they are aiming for, not necessarily expecting what they're aiming for. I think the description that Moshe quoted in this week's article from an American former diplomat, you know, along the lines of a hopeless action by hopeless people, is apt, though. To me, what we're dealing with isn't a well-founded calculation. I think it's an act of desperation. That if you look at not only the West Bank, but in particular Gaza, I mean, it was only a short time ago. It's certainly seared into my memory. And that is, Gazans walking to the border, walking to the barbed wire, the trenches that surround them, and systematically being gunned down by Israeli soldiers. And we all know the stories of observers, of press people, and all the rest of it. From their point of view, they've tried everything. And actually, if we look at Hamas, and I'll come to Hamas later on in my political report, there's no doubt that it, in its own way, has been collaborating, not on the level of Fatah or anything like that, but nonetheless, it has been collaborating.
They do.
Could we have Andy?
Right. Okay, Joseph.
Silenced. It's very difficult. Thank you, Andy. There's no doubt that there's been a level of collaboration, and there's also no doubt there's been some sort of political movement in terms of Hamas. I'm not saying it's embraced a two-state solution, but it's certainly moved in that direction. So from Hamas's point of view, from the point of view, actually, I would argue, of the Palestinian masses, what the hell can we do to change our situation? What can we do to change this completely unacceptable situation? And under desperate conditions, we've seen desperate actions. And anyone who describes, you know, as you'll get in the mainstream press and from mainstream politicians in the imperialist world, that these people were cowardly, clearly this was, you know, a military operation that amounted to a suicide operation. I don't know how many people they sent. It would appear to be over 1,000. You know, how many have returned from this operation? How many are going to die over the next week, over the next month? One would presume the majority of Hamas fighters will die in the very near future. So I'm stressing that this is a desperate act, and I'm also stressing that it's based, at least from where I can see things, and this does depend on how things develop, on not on a rational, well-founded calculation about the situation in the general Middle East, but a very, very outside possibility. Okay, let's move on. just to make the point that we've seen throughout the world mass protest demonstrations, huge protests on Friday, as would be expected in the Middle East, so in Turkey, Jordan, in other Muslim countries, huge turnout in solidarity with the Palestinians. In Britain, I haven't got the full list of where protests took place. You know, the list that I noted down, I've had comrades just writing in after I'd made these notes that I was on a demonstration yesterday in X town or wherever it happens to be. So I've got Liverpool, Bristol, Cambridge, Norwich, Coventry, Edinburgh, Swansea, Glasgow, and I know there are many more. I and other comrades were on the demonstration in London yesterday. It was, I don't know how big, but it was packed in terms of the street. It took an hour to pass us initially. From my sort of training on these things, that would give it, roughly speaking, the level of 30, 40, maybe 50,000 people. I don't know what the official figure is. I don't know what the police figure is. This is a Jack Conrad figure that if something takes us, you know, about an hour to pass by, that's roughly speaking 50,000 people. Either way, it was a mixed demonstration, quite a lot of old peaceniks, you know, CND types, lots of, as you would expect, Muslims, lots of British Asians and the British left, but with some exceptions. I wouldn't say that the turnout of the left was by any means impressive. And of course, what was noticeable was no Labour MPs, of course, spoke from any platform. Jeremy Corbyn did. Is he a Labour MP? Well, he's a Labour member, but is suspended and will remain suspended from the Labour Party in Parliament until the next general election. Diane Abbott, no speech. She's suspended. She's still trying to get in. No hope. No one else. And also, in spite of a call from the Morning Star for trade union banners and Labour Party banners, unless I missed it, no trade union banners apart from, how should I put it, maybe half a dozen. Certainly no Labour Party banners. And indeed, much to my surprise, no banner from the Communist Party of Britain or their young Communist League. Now, what is significant about these demonstrations is not just the good turnout, but the reaction from the establishment. And I'll just, you know, give you our Home Secretary, Suella Braverman. She's actually wanting to criminalise these demonstrations. So she's instructed the police to look out for what she's described as racially motivated pro-Hamas sentiments. But she's interpreted that not only in terms of speeches. For example, we had some arrests yesterday. We had an arrest in Brighton. I don't know what was said, but we do know that when it comes to the slogan, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. In other words, the call for a one-state solution, that's how I'm interpreting it, wherein Israeli Jews will have religious rights, not national rights. So I'm not an advocate of it, but this is being interpreted by our Home Secretary as possibly being something that's racially motivated, that's calling for the removal of Israel from the map using violent means, and therefore should be open to criminal prosecution. We've also had the waving of, believe it or not, the Palestinian flag falling under that category. And that explains why the Weekly Worker this week simply had a plain Palestinian flag on the front page. This is not only to display our solidarity with the Palestinian masses, it's also, as we were explaining to people on the demonstration who were taking the paper yesterday, be careful with this paper because the police might arrest you. I'm not taking that seriously, but that is seriously something that the Home Secretary is pushing for. And if you want to see why I'm not just dealing in hyperbole, look over to Germany, where demonstrations have been banned. Look over to France, where pro-Palestinian demonstrations have been banned. And I know it's not only a question of pro-Palestinian demonstrations that have been banned in France. I know of a play written by an Iraqi comrade that describes in a critical way, actually, a suicide bomber, a critical play. He is not an advocate. He's not an apologist. He's not an anti-Semite. That has been banned in France. He's a British-based playwright. So we have this creeping oppression. And of course, what's been going on in schools needs to be mentioned, because last time round, we wait to see what happens this time round. Last time we had, attacks on Gazans, and that's when they were going towards, marksmen, shooting them in the legs or killing them. School kids who were going in with Palestinian scarves, were going in to school with Palestinian badges or put the colours of Palestine on their cheeks, were being reported by, I would guess, Tory teachers, or it could be right-wing Labour teachers, I don't know, or maybe Zionist teachers, I don't know. But there are reports of not one, two, three, four, but tens of school kids being reported to the Home Office's Prevent unit. This is people that should be looked at as potential bombers. That's what's been going on. In other words, what we've got is a freezing of debate, both in the wider public realm, but also in schools, also in universities. And of course, what we've had and what we'll have is the use of the so-called International Holocaust Memorial Association definition of anti-Semitism. That will be used now against people who are objecting to Israel's, what would seem like to me, preparations for the ethnic cleansing of the Gaza Strip. I mean, maybe they won't do it, but that seems to be the language. That seems to be where the line of travel is going towards. And of course, you know, what we have is Britain, no surprise, its Home Secretary, its Prime Minister, lining up behind the United States. And so although we get Blinken, although we get Biden urging restraint, we don't have anything other than words. We have full backing for Israel. According to our prime minister, Israel has the right to defend itself. And my reply to that is, do the Palestinians have the right to resist? And it would seem not, as far as our Home Office, as far as our prime minister is concerned. And if we're talking about rivers and we're talking about a sea, we're talking, of course, about the Mediterranean. Of course, we're talking about the Jordan. If we're talking about anybody who's actually in the position to achieve a one-state solution on such a piece of geography, on such a piece of territory, it's not the Palestinians. That's a dream, isn't it? You know, I mean, they can chant a slogan to that effect, but can they actually deliver such a result? Well, of course not. Certainly, they're in no position to do that at the present time. And indeed, what's been going on the West Bank is a piecemeal annexation, colonization over the years, a bit here, a bit there. The ratchet gets tightened and tightened. More and more settlers, more and more troops, military zones, and all the rest of it. And now we have, I think, the possibility of 2 million people being cleared off the territory of Gaza. So if anyone is in a position, of course, to deliver a one-state solution, which will have an awful lot fewer Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, it's, of course, the Zionists, who are now united in a war cabinet. This is something that they can actually enforce. And the balance of forces is, of course, in favor of Israel. Not only are they armed to the teeth, not only have they got nuclear weapons, they've got the backing of the leading capitalist powers, crucially, since 1967, the backing of the world hegemon, the United States. Of course, we have those on the left. I'm sure they are absolutely sincere. Jeremy Corbyn, who did speak yesterday to the demonstration, you know, as it ended up in Whitehall opposite Downing Street. He condemns Israel. He condemns, yes, the excesses of Hamas. But what he appeals to is international law. That what Israel is doing is against international law. Well, the precise problem is that Israel is not going to be held account to international law. I cannot see the situation in the immediate future of Benjamin Netanyahu being hauled up to The Hague. He might be, if he falls in Israel, and might find himself in front of Israeli courts, but I don't see him in front of an international court. And the same goes, of course, for the crimes of the United States. And we can list them off, can't we? You know, in terms of Libya, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam. And I'm going to leave aside Latin America and the coups and the butchery that the United States has presided over. And if anything, what happens, of course, as we have in the article this week by Yasmin Mather, if anything, what we have is imperialist politicians being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, a badge of shame, if ever there was. So, yes, we've had Nelson Mandela awarded, that's true, the Nobel Peace Prize. Once he was out, once he was delivering a pro-imperialist transition from apartheid to black rule. And the only exception I can think of, as we've got in the article, is the opposite number to Henry Kissinger, who refused to accept the Nobel Peace Prize because there wasn't peace in South Vietnam. He wasn't a sellout. But if we look at the rest of them, these were people that were doing the bidding of international imperialism or were direct servants or direct instruments of international imperialism. So, yeah, Gorbachev, international, you know, well, Nobel Peace Prize, say no more. OK. So what's the situation? Well, as far as I know, as I speak, we have yet to see Israel act. We all know it's coming. The ground war. We know where the zone, the initial zone of conflict will be. If you look on the map, where Israel, the Israeli so-called defense forces, told people where to get out from. This consists of the northern part of the Gaza Strip. So that includes two big refugee camps to the north of Gaza City, Gaza City itself. So I don't know what the population of that is, but I would guess well over a million people. And I did hear initially the BBC, and they clearly misunderstood. They were reporting that Israel was telling the Gazan, the whole population of Gaza, to get out. And my response to that was, as I'm sure it was of Gazan people themselves, one, no, because we've done that before. And if we get out, they'll never let us back in. But get out, how? You know, the border is closed. Are they expecting the population of Gaza to get out by boat? Well, the Israeli Navy is there. And of course, the Israelis might well want people in desperation to take to boats. They might well want a situation of where people physically break down the border that separates Egypt from the Gaza Strip. Either way, what we have now is a position of where there is no, mainstream electricity supply, no mainstream water supply. We have hundreds of thousands of people leaving the north, going to the south, going to relatives, crowding into UN schools and hospitals, and who knows what. What are they meant to drink? What are they meant to eat? What are people who are being evacuated from hospitals? What's going to happen to them? What you do know in these situations is it doesn't take long for disease to break out. What then happens when there's no medical service? Then you start to get into a situation of where dozens, hundreds, thousands of people start dying. And that is excluding what Israel will do in the north. And quite frankly, I'm in no position to judge militarily what's going to happen in the north. We know that they're going to pound it, they're going to bombard it. We know that they're going to go in on the land, but we also know from Israeli reports, from friendly Arab reports, from all number of different reports over the years, and over the indeed the decades, what we've seen is Hamas, and it is mainly Hamas, but not exclusively, dig, 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 and dig. And so that is what one of the channels, for example, that allowed them to attack Israel. It's true that they went by air. They also went by sea. They went directly over land. But we know that underneath Gaza, there's a whole warren of tunnels. And what exactly the approach militarily will be of the Israelis, I don't know. I mean, I have read reports way back. It shows my age, I suppose, of the horror of Americans conducting tunnel warfare in South Vietnam. And I've seen film of the NLF, National Liberation Front, so-called Viet Cong, who had hospitals underground that were able to withstand B-52 bombers, which just pounded the whole of what used to be called Indochina. And when you travel in that part of the world, what will strike you? If you, I went by train, but also went by plane from north to south. And what struck me is this very green land, but pockmarked with fish ponds. If you go to villages, they've all got three, four, five, six, 10 fish ponds. Well, these are craters that were left by American bombers. And from my understanding, I never went to Laos. Laos was hit, and so was Cambodia, hit far more savagely than Vietnam itself, which was just horrendous. So that will be going on, in Gaza. But do they take the choice of going down those tunnels with flamethrowers, with gas? I presume Hamas has made preparations to combat that. I don't know. I don't know what choice they're going to make. Either way, it's a quite a frightening military operation. And note, for what it's worth, and I'm just sort of flagging it, that Israel, I think the only war Israel really has lost was the war in Lebanon against the Hezbollah, because they dug in. And we're seeing, you know, what that warfare is like, you know, played out in a different way, I admit it. But nonetheless, the beating, the cost in human lives that attackers have to accept if they're going to conduct that warfare. We're seeing that in Ukraine. You know, tens of thousands of people will die. So does Israel take that route, or do they use other methods to destroy these tunnels? I don't know. That's the long and the short answer from me. But they're clearly, that's their stated aim, is to eliminate Hamas. And from what I can see, the aim to achieve that aim, they're going to have to clear people out the way. And I'll come to Hamas in a minute. Just to look at the unequal nature of this contest, Israel has called up 300,000 reservists, and that adds to the 170,000 standing army. And on top of that, of course, as we know, I've already mentioned it, Israel has nuclear bombs. I'm not suggesting that that would be an option, but who the hell knows? We did have, the, after all, the Americans using the excuse that any time that nuclear bomb has been used was against Japan. And the excuse was this will save thousands and thousands of lives of American GIs, that if we force Japan to surrender. But will Hamas surrender if they nuke Gaza City? I cannot see it myself. Either way, Israel has planes, Israel has tanks, Israel has ships, Israel has nuclear weapons, and the Palestinians, Hamas, has nothing in comparison. It has 30,000 fighters. How many of them are alive at the present time? I don't know, but I would guess vast majority of them, but they will fight and they will put up a stiff resistance. That will be my guess, because what else can they do? There is the possibility, and we've seen a little bit of it, but again, this is something I can't and no one can talk authoritatively, because it's this is in the, how should you put it, the hands of the actual actors themselves. You can't predict it. What's going to happen on the northern border? Will Hezbollah act? Will Iran give the go-ahead for Hezbollah to act? We can't say. Will the masses be demanding that Hezbollah act? What will the Palestinians in the north be doing? And then we have the whole question of Jordan. You know, an incredibly unstable state with a huge Palestinian population that clearly identifies with their brothers and sisters in Gaza. What's going to be happening in other parts of the Middle East? I mean, one casualty of the war so far seems to be the Abrahamic Accords, you know, that was Jared Kushner and all the rest of it. What's going to happen in Saudi Arabia? I don't know how many Palestinians there are in Saudi Arabia, other than to say a lot. How many Palestinians are in Kuwait? I mean, they're spread out throughout the Middle East. What are these people going to do? How stable is the House of Saud? How stable is the Hashemite monarchy in Jordan? All I can say is that at least, you ask the question and you can then see the sort of reasoning of Hamas that I'm guessing, as I said at the beginning, that their logic is precisely to bring the temple down. This is what this desperate act was in terms of them going in to Israel. Okay, just as, and I'll come to the left in a minute, but just on that, just wanted to add in a commentary and just go, no to it. And that's the line of the Socialist Workers' Party in Britain. They have a front page, as you'd expect, victory to the Palestinian people. Well, yeah. But inside, what we have is Charlie Kimber, the editor of the paper, writing along the lines of, and I'm quoting, by the way, so it's not just me putting, I'm not putting words in his mouth, rejoice, rejoice at the Hamas attack. I don't share that sentiment, and I've tried to indicate why I don't share that sentiment, because to me, their attack is an act of desperation. It's not something that is solidly based. It isn't something that's going to produce progressive results. If anything, and I'll elaborate, the chances are that what we'll see is a descent, a further descent, and you have to say further, not a descent into, but a further descent into barbarism. And so our Charlie, he compares it with, and I see sort of why, but I don't concur. He compares Hamas's action by their 1,000, maybe 1,500 fighters, he compares it with the Tet Offensive. Now, for those that remember, or those that have read their history books, this was the offensive organized by the Vietnamese against the puppet government of South Vietnam and the forces of the United States. And we were told, I mean, I was a kid, I knew what side I was on, by the way. I was definitely pro Vietnamese, and I was in a minority, of course. All this stuff about everyone was on the side of Vietnam, it's just nonsense. Tiny minority. And of course, the line was fed every night by the BBC that it was the Viet Cong who were the isolated minority carrying out terrorist attacks, and the Americans were there to stop the spread of communism, which everyone hated. And what the Tet Offensive showed is America couldn't win. And so, in my memory, we had the flag of the National Liberation Front, red and blue, yellow star over the city of Hue. We had NLF fighters inside the American embassy. We had South Vietnam overrun with fighters. And of course, this was an act of desperation on one level, because I don't know how many fighters there were, but say 80,000, perhaps 60,000 died. But what this told the American public, what it told America's generals, what it told American presidents and strategists and advisors, that you cannot win. And when Kissinger boasted to the Vietnamese, who he was negotiating with, we've got China on side now. China's not going to help you out. They just turned around and said, well, we're still going to win. We're relying on our own resources. Well, they did have the Soviet Union. Either way, the point would be that with that offensive, although in military terms, you could make the argument in terms of who lost the most and all the rest of it, politically, the Americans lost. Politically, the Vietnamese won. And we saw that because once the Americans started to get out, amazingly, I don't know if anyone expected it. I don't think the Vietnamese expected how quickly the South Vietnamese regime just collapsed and how quickly You know, Vietnamese tanks were able to reach Saigon and smash through the American embassy doors with the last helicopter taking off from the roof. But the point would be that the calculations that were made by Vietnamese politicians and generals, I think, were well-founded. They were looking at the global situation. They were looking at the situation in North Vietnam, South Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, the whole of the region. And their calculation proved to be correct. And therefore, you know, in 68, you know, I did rejoice at that military action. But today, I can't. And I've already, you know, made the promise, and here we go, to actually look at the nature of Hamas and its strategy to explain why. Just thought I'd add a footnote to the SWP on that one. I've just been writing the preface to a book on the Soviet Union, and amongst the disgraceful positions of the left at the time, we're talking about 89, 90, 91, we have the headline in Socialist Worker welcoming the collapse of communism. No inverted commas, by the way. They were joining, you know, Ronald Reagan, if I get my presidents right, Mrs. Thatcher, if I get my prime minister right, in celebrating the collapse of communism. So I have questions about the SWP's judgment politically. But basically what Charlie Kimber reckons is that what we're about to see is a repeat of what he calls the Arab revolutions of 2010, 2011. I just don't see that myself. And it's certainly true that if we look at the regimes, I've already mentioned them, you know, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, I would argue that they're highly unstable. But if we look at Hamas and their co-thinkers, I think if we wanted a label, if we want to look at, you know, in terms of understanding these people, you know, they're not the equivalent of the Vietnamese Communist Party. I think it was called the Workers' Party at the time, but you know what I mean. They're not the equivalent of the National Liberation Front. Now, it's true that they have mass support. There's no doubt about that. How much now, I don't know, but I would have thought as a result of what's going on at the moment, I would have thought if they'd lost support, there would be a rallying to them. What we do know is the last elections, okay, it's a long time ago now, I readily admit, but the last elections that we had in occupied Palestine, so that's the West Bank and Gaza, this was 2006, so there's been no elections either in the West Bank or in Gaza since. What we had is Hamas coming out top of the poll. This is throughout occupied Palestine, I'm emphasizing, not just in Gaza. They got 44.45%, call it 45%. And I don't know how many MPs there were. Just as a guess, I would hazard 150 or thereabouts. I haven't noted down the figure. But they got 74 MPs as a result of that vote. The next down the list was Fatah. That's the dominant faction in the PLO. They're the people now who are the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. They got 41.45% and 45 MPs. Next down the list was the Alternative, 2.93. Let's call it 3%, two MPs. Who were the Alternative? Who are the Alternative? Well, I suppose who were would be more accurate. Two organizations in particular worth mentioning, and that's the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine and the Palestinian People's Party. That's the official Communist Party in Palestine. So way down the list. So Hamas didn't get a majority. That's certainly true. But what we saw is Israel, having previously backed Hamas, the rise of Hamas, decides to turn against Hamas, backs Fatah, and we have this civil war. 2007, Hamas gets Gaza, Fatah gets the West Bank. But the point I'm trying to make is we're not dealing with two different politics in terms of the Palestinian masses. We're dealing with two different authorities. That's certainly true. But the Palestinian masses, one still presumes in the West Bank, will have at least a good chunk of that population will have its sympathies for Hamas. Okay, let's look at, got my notes. Yes, I have got them in front of me. Let's just look at the background of Hamas, what sort of an organization. So I've indicated that I don't think it's an isolated terrorist organization. It's a mass-based organization. Its ideology is clearly pan-Islamicist. It has its origins in the Muslim Brotherhood, which was founded in Egypt, from my memory, in the 1920s. This is under British rule, and it was distinguished from communism, but also secularism. And precisely, it preached pan-Islamicism. So Hamas has its contacts in Egypt, will have its contacts in Jordan, will have its contacts in Syria. Of course, it's full of factions and differences, and I'm not trying to portray it as a unified body. Nonetheless, that's its origins. It was formed first in 73. Its official Hamas title, my understanding, is 1987, as I said, with the promotion of the Israelis. The Israelis at that time feared the secular left, people that would been viewed as aligned with the Soviet Union, even though the Soviet Union's clearly showing problems. That would have been their ideology. Okay. Okay. So what I wanted to do is just move in the last bit of this section, and I've already spoken for three quarters of an hour, so I'm going to come to an end soon. What I wanted to do is look at what alternatives the left in Britain in particular, but it amounts to what alternatives the left put forward internationally as well. What we have is the SWP type approach, which is precisely, I already indicated it, Palestine free from the river to the sea, a one state, and often what you get from the old PLO charter is a one state, secular state, within which, and this is, I'm paraphrasing now, within which Jews will have the right to self-determination. But what is meant by that is religious self-determination. Now, the fact of the matter is, I don't know what the statistics are, but I would guess from my sort of half memory is that half the present Jewish population in Israel would consider themselves non-religious. You know, that if you ask them what synagogue they go, I don't go to a synagogue. Maybe they get married in one. I know you have to have religion, you know, is sort of woven into the fabric of the state to some degree. But that historically Zionism, right, is not religious. It's labor Zionism. And I know that's declined, but nonetheless, the dominant tradition of Zionism is secular, which is an irony, isn't it? That why do you have, you know, the right to colonize this land? Well, the British did offer them Uganda, wasn't it, or something like that. Apparently, it's because, you know, God offered it to, was it Moses? So you have that, your children. I'm not saying he wasn't allowed to go there, was he? Either way, this is, when someone doesn't believe that that's the word of God, this is taking the biscuit. It's a bit like me looking around for Welsh people who've got pure Welsh blood and saying you have the right to the whole of Britain because all the rest of us are foreign invaders. And even you lot came from abroad somewhere with the retreat of the ice sheet. So obviously that's nonsense. But yeah, the point I'm really making is that the SWP wants a bourgeois solution within which, at least roughly speaking, half the population don't have national rights, are not recognized as a nationality, but only as a religion, even though only, well, I'd say a minority, I don't know, maybe a half, do not believe in God. So to me, that doesn't really have legs. And then who's going to deliver it? And then I'm into the position of, well, okay, it's not going to be America, is it? It's not going to be the United Nations. I mean, the United Nations only has troops if the Security Council agrees them. That's not going to happen. So who delivers this? And then the SWP would say, well, you know, the regional revolution. Okay. Either way, in my book, at least, they're missing something because they're not at least trying to put forward anything strategically that could win over the Israeli masses. Maybe you'll never win them over, but you should surely try as part of your strategy. You should surely try. And the idea, by the way, of having a state of where you keep, at least roughly speaking, I'm saying roughly speaking, there are as many Palestinians are there as there are Israeli Jews. The idea of having half the population that are kept in a state by Beinet is surely not a Marxist approach to politics. What we want is the voluntary union of people, not the forcible unity of people. And we're not talking about you, me, or an individual. We're talking about now what is a historically constituted people. So yes, they are colonists, and the majority, vast majority of them are. This is an ongoing colonial project, but this is not the equivalent of Britain, you know, in the Yemen, or Britain in the equivalent in India. There is no Jewish homeland for these people to go back to. There's no mother country, and it's not that sort of colonization anyway. It's like looking at the American people today, I'm saying, and saying, go back home. I mean, clearly that's nonsense. Okay, we're not dealing with something that's so old now. Nonetheless, that's the point I would make. I would make the point that the current Israeli population is now historically constituted, and you need to deal with them in that way. Okay, and then we have those also on the left that believe in a two-state solution. And a two-state solution can either be of a bourgeois sort, which is what the Morning Star, Official Communism, and all the rest of them believe in. So you have two bourgeois states and you have peace between these two. Who brings it about? Well, again, I'm somewhat mystified, other than peace and goodwill on both sides. So I'm skeptical on that one. Or we have the Socialist Party in England and Wales, and there are many other advocates of it, two socialist states. So if you look at the current edition of The Socialist, calls for two separate socialist states. For the life of me, comrades, why on earth, if the working class comes to power, you know, in present day Israel and present day Palestine, and apparently, according to these comrades, they will share a joint capital. What on earth are two socialist states doing being separate? Do the people hate each other so much? I mean, surely the project of socialism is the merger of nations, the fusion of states. I mean, the Russian Revolution was predicated not just on the Russian Revolution, it was predicated on the German Revolution and the European Revolution. And the Russian Revolution, you know, the proletarian led peasant revolution, merging in with the European socialist state. Anyway, I'm still mystified of how you're going to get this socialist two states, two socialist states. Apparently, their slogan is also somewhat bizarrely to me, a community defense on both sides. Well, I would actually argue, to the extent you've got community defense, it's called Fatah and its armed wing. It's called Hamas and its armed wing. and community defense. I mean, the Israeli army is a conscript army. I don't know what the age is, I presume 18, and then you remain a reservist, and they've just got 300,000, excuse me, people. It's a mass army. Is that the solution? So hence, again, it's a long shot. It's not a simple solution. And that's the question of a regional solution. And the regional solution has to involve, in my view at least, working class leadership. You know, it's only with working class leadership can you actually seriously go with a straight face to the Israeli working class and say, well, you've got something to gain here as opposed to something to lose. Instead of replacing your position as you're part of the oppressors with now you're part of the oppressed, you can have religious rights, but you can't have anything else. No, you can have national rights. So hence my own view is while I would want some sort of socialist federation, I don't see why you need a federation, why you can't have more centralized state, but that's for the people themselves to decide. I'm not going to insist on anything. Who am I to insist on anything? But at least under those circumstances, have you got the possibility of splitting the Israeli population and bringing important sections, perhaps the majority, over to your side, or at least neutralizing the vast majority? That is a strategy that you need. And I admit that the traction, for example, which I would support the call for an Arab revolution along the lines of a unified Germany, unified Italy, that's gone down over recent decades. But then it's also true with the left in general. None of us can point to, there you are in this country, the left is strong and healthy and shows the potential to be hegemon. We're all looking at things in something of a hypothetical manner. And you have to basically look at what's the most likely strategy that you can pursue without being dogmatic about it. What's the most likely one that will succeed? It's like looking at the party question. None of us can turn around and say, here, we're the answer. And anyone who does, I think, is a fool or a charlatan. No, none of us have got the answer that's so obvious. The question is examining the program, examining the strategy that's available and say, this seems at least to have the possibility of producing a humane, rational solution, as opposed to the SWP, which seems to be backing Hamas, which is a reactionary organization. And if we did have, you know, under its hegemony, and I'm not suggesting that Hamas, a group in Gaza, you know, where it exercises semi-state power, but if we think about the Muslim Brotherhood and that sort of outlook, what sort of regime would we be seeing in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, in Syria, in Jordan today? Nothing that would be conducive to working class, to trade unionism. And in that sense, and I'm going to finish my remarks on this section and just add a few little notes at the end, by the way. I'm reminded of comrades who Yasmin Mather is criticizing, and I think rightly, in the paper this week. That's an organization called Raagar, which means workers' voice in Farsi. And they were born in prison under the Shah. And the first edition of their journal paper that came out was under conditions of Khomeini coming to power. And they led with the headline, "The revolution is dead. Long live the revolution." So in my view, if the SWP's perspective had its way, we would be experiencing the sort of terror of the Khomeini regime. Now, I don't know what the state of the left is in Saudi Arabia, except it must be extremely underground. The left in other parts in the Middle East is extremely weak. But if it did grow and a Muslim Brotherhood came to power, they would crush us. They would mercilessly crush us. They would execute us. They would drive us abroad. And we need to understand understand that. Okay, well, I've spoken long enough. I've already spoken for an hour. I make no apology on one level, simply because of the gravity of the situation. But I just thought I'd add in Australian article. Our comrade predicted the result, not the statistics. It was 60%. That's my understanding. I also read 55. So maybe it's in terms of turnout. Low turnout, a no vote. Were they all racist? No. Is there racism in Australia? Yes. Note that a lot of Aboriginal, I know that that word is open to question, but I call them First Nation people in Australia, voted no or boycotted it because something without power that has no voice is a voice you don't listen to. Secondly, I need three items. Ukraine, we have a Russian offensive. That seems to be what is taking place in Donetsk. It could be other fronts as well. Ukraine talks about how many tanks, how many armored cars it's destroyed. Maybe it's true. I doubt it. But it would be true on the other side. To conduct an offensive operation is highly costly. We're into a war of attrition. And, you know, to gain tiny little fragments of territory, and the present fight is around a place called Advika. That's the best pronunciation you're going to get off me at the moment. Thousands of people will be dying. Lastly, writing on the wall, Rishi Sunak and the Tory party, as a result, or are in the aftermath of their Manchester conference, High Speed 2, and other far cited plans that Rishi laid out. They have not enjoyed a bounce. They've enjoyed a slump in support. And as a result of the Liverpool conference, I don't know whether it was the glitter that was sprinkled over Keir Starmer, the Labour Party is up 2 points and is now on 44% of the poll, compared with the Tories, 28%. In other words, although it's not a done deal, in terms of our political thinking, we need to prepare for a reactionary Labour government. A reactionary Labour government that, when it comes to civil rights, will be as equally repressive as Suella Braverman. Just note that in the Labour Party conference, not only was there no Palestinian flags, as there has been in previous years, to use the word Israeli apartheid was verboten. You could, and that's something that comes from the United Nations. You cannot, that's something you can read in the Israeli press. That is not allowed in today's Labour Party. And those that are keeping their mouths shut, it's political suicide. What is the point of the Socialist Campaign Group if it doesn't voice a protest now? What is the point of it when it didn't protest about the witch hunt? It's useless, and it will be useless under a Keir Starmer government. The idea that they will suddenly discover courage when Keir Starmer is in number 10, if he gets in number 10, and I, as I said, I think he will, the idea that they suddenly discover they've got a backbone, no, they're spineless, they are jelly, they are useless. That's what these people are. The only thing that interests them is their pathetic little careers, keeping their expense counts and keeping themselves as important, supposedly important people. Thank you, Anne. That's it.